Drua, moon of Almania.
In the silvery light of dawn, Ben stood under a sidewalk cafe awning beside a nearly deserted city street and stared up at the soaring Crossroads business habitat. It was unlovely in the extreme, a greenish column extending 800 meters up into the sky, with decorative yellow-white structures like planetary rings situated every five floors. The data card Saha had given him included a data file on Drua, including a mention that the Crossroads building was one of the system's few acknowledgments that there was life outside Almania. Trang Robotics, one of the system's largest industries, traded a tremendous number of computer systems and droids to the Alliance, the Chiss, and other large collectives of planets and cultures. But the locals, by and large, ignored the fact that anything existed beyond their star system. The occasional firm like Crossroads seemed to exist principally to rub such unwelcome news in the faces of Almanians. The building housed the local offices of hundreds of off-world firms as they tried, usually successfully, to arrange for advantageous purchase deals from local technological firms, or attempted, usually unsuccessfully, to market their own goods in this system. At this early hour, there was already a stream of workers entering the ground-level doors of the Crossroads building. Most looked to Ben as though they were off-worlders, like himself. At some point, he would have to join them. Go up to the 215th floor, find and break into the display case, replace the real amulet there with the fake he carried in his pocket, and get out undetected. The wall behind him slid up, revealing the cafe's interior. Warm air smelling of fresh baked goods rolled across Ben, and he abruptly realized that he was hungry. The proprietor, a tall man with the build and gut of a Gamorrean, stepped out among his tables, looked up and down at the sidewalk foot traffic, and glanced at Ben.
"Here to eat, son?"
Ben nodded. The man tapped a tabletop, motioning for Ben to sit there. The tabletop lit up, four points on it revealing themselves to be displays showing the establishment's morning menu.
"Calf, please," Ben said, "and cruffy pot pie."
"Tap it out, son, and put in your credit card. No mistakes that way."
Ben entered his order and slid his credit card into the slot at the table center. The table surface went ding, and the word declined in red was superimposed over the menu. Below it, more text read, "Account not found. Please insert another credit card."
"Hey," Ben said, "your table is broken."
The proprietor moved over to look. He pointed at a symbol at the menu's lower left corner, an animation of tiny blaster bolts crisscrossing right to left and left to right.
"No. Holocom data links live. That means it's checking all the way back to wherever your account's supposed to be. And there's no account to find. Got another credit card? Or coin?"
Ben felt in his pocket. There was one cred coin there. His last. He'd planned to get local coins through his cred card. He shook his head. The proprietor gave him a sympathetic look.
"Well, go ask your mother or father for more."
The hunger Ben was feeling was graduating from mild to sharp and painful.
"Maybe,"
he said,
"you could let me have my breakfast, and I'd get Dad to pay you back later today."
To his suggestion, he added a sizable push through the force. The proprietor laughed.
"I could, but after a year of doing that, I'd be out of business. Off with you, son."
Banking kiosks turned out to be no help. Twice Ben inserted his credit card in their slots and tried to access his account, but all he received was a cryptic "account not found" screen. He tried to send a message to the establishment, but even a tiny data query would cost money if sent over a holocom connection, and he had no money to draw on. Well, that had to change. He had to, as his mother had put it so many times, acquire resources. And in this situation, that meant stealing. He hesitated over that. Stealing was wrong. Sure, everybody in his family had hijacked ships at one time or another, but those were always emergencies. Nobody stole for breakfast credits. But this wasn't just breakfast credits. He was on a mission, one he was proud to have been assigned, one that was important and might save the lives of Jedi and guards. Didn't that make it an emergency? He decided it did. He drifted across the street to stand near the doors into the Crossroads building. A public conveyance airspeeder pulled to a landing in front of the building, and its driver hopped out to open a front-end cargo compartment and offload luggage. The passenger exited and waited on the walkway. A small portfolio of black simulated Nerf leather opened in his hand. And tucked into many of the numerous little pockets of that portfolio, Ben saw were cred cards. Some were banking institution cred cards, the sort that required validation from the institution to access funds. But others were stamped to indicate that they carried their own value in their memory. Ben knew what he could do. He drifted closer. When the driver was finished and three pieces of luggage rested on the walkway, the passenger handed him one of the institutional cards. At that moment, Ben flicked a finger and exerted himself through the force. One of the other cards, the lesser ones, leapt free of the portfolio and fluttered to the street. Ben edged closer and pinned the card to the ground with his mental exertion. A moment later, the driver handed the other card back to the passenger, entered the driver's compartment, and accelerated away. The passenger pocketed his portfolio, clumsily picked up the luggage, and moved on into the Crossroads building. Ben moved over beside the street, knelt as if to fiddle with his boot, and picked up the card. And that was it. He was a thief. But he'd only taken a little bit of what the man possessed, and it hurt no one. He made the wrong as small as he possibly could. Half an hour later, well fed on calf and cruffy pot pie, which turned out to be savory fowl meat, vegetables and gravy in a thick pastry shell, he felt ready to put his troubles behind him and get the mission underway. A few minutes with his data pad communicating with a public data terminal gave him some of the information he needed. Tendrondo Arms leased the 212th through 215th floors. That suggested to Ben that the floor he wanted, 215, was where the most important employees had their offices. His mother had told him on numerous occasions that one way people like to feel important was by sitting on top of their subordinates, and the practical way to do this was to have their offices on upper floors. Since the building had its decorative planetary rings every five stories, starting with the sixth story, then 215 had to be just beneath one of those rings. Ben searched the building directory and found that Lister Innovations leased the next three floors, 216 through 218. Lister Innovations' public records indicated that the firm employed quality specialists and idea generators who would visit other companies and tell them how to do their jobs better. Ben frowned over that, dubious, but decided that descending from 216 might be the easiest way to get onto 215 unobserved. He occupied himself for another hour researching Tendrondo Arms' local office and Lister Innovations, then spent the rest of the morning and some of the afternoon buying things, food and bottled liquids that would not rapidly deteriorate, 20 meters of thin, pliant, strong cable, basic mechanical tools, a box of sweets, a length of red ribbon, and a large backpack. The last of the credits on the card he'd stolen went to buying himself a hot midday meal. As the workday grew late and workers began streaming out of the Crossroads building in anticipation of shift change, Ben entered the building, backpack on his shoulders and ribbon-wrapped box of sweets in his hands, and took the turbo lift up to 216. The doors opened into a jungle. Ben stared at healthy trees growing up out of dark, moist-looking soil, saw a distant solar light through the trees that was a whiter hue than Almania's sun. Somewhere in the distance, water splashed. There was no sound of industry, of harassed workers, of overtaxed terminals. He stepped out onto the jungle floor, and the turbolift doors closed behind him. He turned to look at them and saw only a sheer rock face. It was a perfect illusion. He grinned toward the trees. "It's all mechanical," he told himself.
"So it is."
The voice, male, came from only a few meters ahead.
"Follow the path, please."
The path, the ground and leaves underfoot convincingly soft and resilient, led forward, then curved right, revealing a clearing that should have been visible from the turbolift, but was not. The right half of the clearing was dominated by a stone-lined pool, seemingly natural, into which water from an adjacent waterfall splashed. Next to it was a desk, apparently made of black stone. As it came into view, the man who sat behind it, young and pale-skinned, lowered his lizard skin boots from the desktop and sat forward in a more normal pose.
"Welcome to Lister Innovations," he said. "Can I help you?"
"What is all this?"
Ben asked, gesturing around.
"Corporate culture."
The man offered Ben a big, practiced smile to go with his big, practiced words.
One of the things we do is show companies how to establish and maintain their own cultural identities through environmental design. Here in our receiving area, the floor, walls, and decorative pillars are made of or coated with our patented chameleon cover material, which allows the ultimate in decorative versatility. With just a few words, I can establish a new tone, a new work environment. For instance, decor, purity.
He'd hardly finished the second word when a change rippled through the chamber. Trees straightened, becoming vertical, absolutely symmetrical, their branches folding up into their sides. The floor flattened into a perfect plane, and Ben, balancing, could feel it harden under his feet. Most objects faded to white smoothness, the trees becoming featureless and gleaming. Even the man's clothes transformed from their green scale texture to pure white. His desk became silver, and the rim of stones around the pool became a silvery seating bench. The man was watching him closely, and Ben did not need to tap into the force to feel that he wanted Ben to be impressed. He lives for praise, Ben thought, and Jason says that when you give people what they want, they can be more cooperative.
Wow, Ben said. I mean, wow.
Wow, indeed.
The man smiled, apparently satisfied.
So, are you looking for someone in particular?
Oh, yeah.
Ben pretended to consult his datapad.
I have something for, Gilthor Breen.
I'm Gilthor Breen.
I know that, Ben thought. Your face and your name are on the company's public page, and a whole long list of your likes and dislikes.
Then this is for you.
He put the beribboned box on the desktop. Gilthor looked closely at Ben, then subjected the box to the same scrutiny. He pulled the ribbon end to untie the bow, then opened the box and gave a brief, uncertain smile when he saw the variety of sweets within.
Is there a note?
Ben checked his datapad again.
No note. She just left a short message. 2 days.
2 days? She? Who's she? What's her name?
Ben shrugged.
She didn't leave one, but she was very short, with long black hair and black eyes. And cute. Really cute.
This was a description of Aliniaka Vare, a young holodrama actress currently in vogue. She was from the world of Balmora, like Gilthor himself, and she was his favorite actress. Three facts that Ben had found on Gilthor's personal page. Ben wasn't going to try to persuade Gilthor that his admirer was Vare herself. It just seemed reasonable that if Gilthor admired Vare, he'd also be interested in a woman who looked like her. Apparently, he'd guessed correctly. Gilthor practically began to vibrate in his chair.
2 days, he said. Until what? Maybe she'll be in touch again. That's it.
Abruptly realizing that Ben was still present, he dug into a pocket and drew out a cred coin.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Can I use your refresher?
Of course. Decor, refresher.
A melodious droid voice to Ben's left said,
Here I am.
And when Ben glanced toward it, he saw that one of the silver panels was now cycling between silver and black. Ben smiled and trotted that way, stepping inside a refresher. Ben set himself up in one of the stalls, hand lettering a sign that read, In need of repair. Maintenance has been summoned. Repair scheduled for tomorrow. This he placed on the front of the stall, and he kept his force senses and more ordinary senses sharp, straining to hear or feel anyone who might approach this refresher chamber. But no one did, and he could feel Gilthor outside, seated at his desk. He could also feel a steady stream of life moving up and down the turbo lift, mostly down as the offices were depopulated by the late hour. But no one came to this refresher before Ben was done. With his tools, Ben unscrewed one viewport panel from the wall and carried all his equipment through it to rest on the planetary ring structure beyond. Twilight was gathering outside, and from here, Ben could see all the lights of the city, the majority of them pale blue, pale green, or white, a striking difference from the nighttime skies of Coruscant and all their spectral beauty. The decorative ring turned out to be made of plasteel, mounted sturdily to the building exterior. It shifted not at all under the occasional breeze. A gap of about 10 centimeters separated it from the building edge, and through the gap, Ben could see the regularly spaced mounting struts that held the ring to the building exterior. Though in the growing darkness, Ben didn't think he could be seen. He kept his movements to a minimum as he repositioned the transparasteel panel he'd removed and carefully dogged it back into place. Then he knotted the cable he'd brought at 1 meter intervals. He tied it at about the middle, around one of the support struts visible through the gap. He threaded one half down through the gap, tossing the other over the edge. Carefully, he lowered himself over the edge and climbed down the cable. This put him directly opposite one of the viewports of the Tendrondo Arms offices. It was only dimly lit, and hanging there, Ben could see it was furnished mostly with sturdy-looking stand-up lockers as tall as a human man. Weapons lockers, he guessed, given that Tendrondo was an arms manufacturing firm. He descended a few more meters on his cable, bringing him down opposite the 214th floor, and began shifting his weight, causing him to swing toward the building wall and the other half of the cable dangling there. After a few moments, his swings brought him close enough to that cable to grab it. He let go of the first one, leaving him dangling next to the building wall, and climbed back up to 215. Leaning in close to the viewport, he could see the mechanical control that opened the viewport from within. It seemed from this angle to be a simple hand crank, but its handle was now folded against its shaft, and the control itself was snugly fitted within a small transparasteel cylinder with a mechanical lock holding the cylinder to the apparatus. Ben studied it for a few moments and decided he understood its workings. With a handle up against the shaft and the smooth transparasteel cylinder in the way, an ordinary person's grip strength could probably not develop the torque necessary to open the window. He half-closed his eyes and concentrated on the apparatus. He reached out to it through the force, gripping it as he'd grip his lightsaber hilt to yank it to him, and twisted. It didn't budge. He tried the other direction. Now it did move, a few degrees of arc. He frowned, concentrating harder, and the crank began to rotate very slowly. It was hard work. In a couple of minutes, the viewport was open enough to admit him. He scrambled through, pulled the release length of cable, and dropped to the floor. He was happy. He could relax for a moment, and all he had to do at this point was make a covert search of the offices, find the display case, swap the amulet, and make his way to the ground again. Easy. Ben looked at the display case, and his heart sank. It hadn't taken long to find. The Tendrondo offices all seemed to have been emptied by the hour, so there were no people to dodge. The display case was not in any of the individual executives' offices, but in the central chamber, dominated by a big desk and a receptionist protocol droid whose optics were unlit, indicating that it was in sleep mode. The chamber itself contained a dozen or so displays, chiefly statuettes and plaques commemorating unusually advantageous business deals made on Drua. Some of the items were unusual presents given to the local office, such as a set of tiny acrobat droids, each no taller than Ben's hand was wide, even now doing tumbling routines on their shelf of the display case. But the transparasteel top had been carefully removed from the display case, and the amulet of Kalara was gone. The red velvet pillow it had rested on was still there, as was the silver-on-black sign next to it, Amulet of Kalara, presented to Stanius Leem by the grateful victors of the insurrection of Iliabath. But there was no amulet on the pillow itself. Instead, there was a hand-lettered piece of flimsy. It read, "I will return the amulet to where it belongs. Be grateful that I spared your lives." It was signed, Faskus of Xyost. There was something else in the case, too. It was a trace of emotion. Ben could detect through the force a sense of happiness, glee. The gloating of a Sith lifetime had to have infused the amulet, and a little of that emotion had been left behind in the case. Someone else had stolen the amulet he meant to steal. That wasn't fair, and it had to have been done recently, within the last couple of hours. If it had been done yesterday or earlier, the local authorities would have been here to investigate already. And the case wouldn't have looked like this. It would have been closed up, the piece of flimsy removed. Ben closed his eyes and tried to feel something, anything about the theft. But he couldn't. Ben opened his eyes and sighed. He'd failed. He'd failed Jason, and now all the Jedi were at risk. No, wait a minute. Maybe he hadn't. Not yet. Perhaps instead of slinking home and admitting to failure, he could continue the mission, improvising. He might be able to follow this Faskus and take the amulet back from him. But where would Faskus take it? Ben took out his datapad and accessed files that he hadn't read before, those pertaining to the amulet's origin and history. The main file on the subject said that it had been fabricated on Zyost some 2,000 standard years ago, and that the dark side energies invested in it kept it from corroding or showing wear. Stolen by a man from Zyost, crafted on Zyost, Faskus was obviously going to take the amulet back to Zyost. Ben recognized the name of that planet, and it gave him a little shiver. Zyost was the homeworld of the Sith, the species that had given their name to the Latter Order. In subsequent centuries, Sith referred to Force users of any species who followed the Order's traditions. His datapad yielded a little information on Zyost, and Ben was surprised to discover that as galactic distances went, Zyost was not far from Almania, a few hours' ride away by shuttle. But no shuttles would be going there. Worlds noted for their inhospitable weather and ancient horrors just were not common tourist destinations. He'd have to acquire transport some other way. 2 minutes after Ben's departure, the protocol droid in the reception area came alive. Its optics lit up, and its head swiveled to look at the display case. The image its visual sensors picked up was compressed and transmitted over a specific comm frequency. Kilometers away, at the Drua spaceport, a 100-meter-long bulk freighter rested in one of the outlying hangars. The freighter's name of record was false. Her transponder indicated that she was the High Tide, while her crew and victims knew her as the Boneyard Rendezvous. The comboard's computer received the distant droid's message, interpreted it, and popped a text message onto the display of its captain, whose name was Byalfin Dior. Dior, an underfed-looking Bothan with lovely bronze-colored fur, looked away from his holodrama and read aloud to the crew members on the bridge.
Red braid in motion. Tracker activated. Confirm handoff.
Hertu, his comm officer, tail gunner, and cook, a Rodian who spent every spare credit having every fifth scale on his body dyed from a light green to a dark blue, jabbered a question.
Yes, answer,
Dyer said.
The captain and the crew of the Boneyard Rendezvous acknowledge that your safe, undemanding part in this escapade is at an end, and accept handover of responsibility. Sleep untroubled, and know that parties far more interesting than you shall carry this torch evermore. Got it?
Hertu stared at him for a few moments. Then he typed, handover acknowledged, on his comm board and sent the message. Dior sighed and returned his attention to the holodrama.
There is no immortal spark within you.
Hertu nodded, admission that the captain was correct.
Track the boy. I want to know where he is every minute of the day.
Bothawi system, aboard the Galactic Alliance frigate Chaminar.
The door into the command center slid open, and the admiral, a paunchy, middle-aged man who nonetheless looked commanding in his white uniform, entered, flanked by two junior officer escorts. One of them called out,
Admiral on the bridge!
Chaminar's commander, a stocky Deveronian, leapt up from his chair and saluted.
Admiral Kloskin, happy to have you aboard.
Kloskin returned the salute, his gesture as crisp as his uniform.
Captain Bjork, good to meet you.
He shook the captain's hand and glanced around the bridge.
We need to speak in private.
At once!
Bjork led the admiral through another door into his private office, which was decorated in shades of deep brown and tan. Kloskin sat, and as Bjork seated himself, handed the captain a data card.
These aren't exactly orders, but authorization for you to take my verbal orders. Chaminar has been detached from ordinary fleet activities and assigned to the Galactic Alliance Guard on a special assignment.
Sir, I don't understand. Chaminar's current assignment is anything but ordinary. We're coordinating all the Alliance's reconnaissance and fighting forces in the Bothawi system, and we're charged with preventing the Bothan fleets from secretly leaving the system. Our assignment is strategic and important.
It would have been if you hadn't been betrayed.
That caused Bjork's spine to stiffen.
Betrayed how?
The GAG has been assigned this mission because certain portions of the military have been compromised,
Kloskin said.
Not too surprising in a time of war, of course, I've spent the last several weeks on special assignment, ferreting out traitors and planning a response.
Bjork had heard that Kloskin had been hastily removed from his command of the task force at Corellia a while back. There had been rumors that he had experienced some sort of breakdown, but any sudden reassignment of a commander was likely to spawn such rumors.
Here is the situation,
Kloskin continued.
Several of the officers under your command are actually in Bothan employ. On the day the Bothans decide to send their fleet into action, they're going to do whatever it takes to keep Alliance forces from discovering that fact, until too late. But we're not going to let that happen. You'll supply me with a list of all officers under your command, and I'll indicate which ones are the traitors. We'll reorganize their duty shifts to leave each of them unobserved and unprotected at specific times, at which point we'll capture or eliminate them. Then we, by which I mean Shamunar, will take the observation zone they would have been covering. We'll plug the hole their absence leaves.
Understood. But, sir, I know many of these officers very well. They're not traitors.
I'm sure the ones you personally vouch for are completely loyal. When you give me the list of officers, be sure to indicate which ones you're certain of.
Kloskin leaned forward to give Bjork a sympathetic clap on the shoulder.
I know this comes as a shock, son, but we'll get it straightened out very quietly, and it won't reflect on your service record.
Thank you, sir.
Druwa, Moon of Almania.
Ben spent the better part of 2 days planning his trip to Xyost. In that time, he performed his credit card stealing technique twice more, and was pleased to discover that it became easier, smoother, and less detectable each time. He did do some planetary database research to find out whether any shuttle carrier or excursion service made trips to Xyost. The answer was a definite, unequivocal no, since Xyost did not appear in any public database. Still, its coordinates were in the files Jason had given him. Nor was there, as far as he could determine, much smuggling activity here. There was nothing to suggest that desperate ship owners, as his Uncle Han had been so many years ago, lurked in every tavern, willing to take aspiring young Jedi wherever they needed to go. Well then, he'd just have to steal a vehicle. Security around the spaceport was not exactly lax, but neither was it set up to deter a Jedi. It didn't take him too long to find the craft he thought best suited to carry him to Xyost. It was an old Y-wing starfighter, carefully maintained, its hull paint unscarred.
Corellian System Exclusion Zone, aboard the Errant Venture.
In the first few days after Errant Venture was authorized to ply its trade for Alliance military personnel in the Corellian system, its casinos and other entertainments did great business. Booster Tarek, the grand old man of the operation, though he was theoretically retired from day-to-day duties, was often seen in the casinos, flitting around in his hover chair, greeting patrons and encouraging workers, his eyes alight in the way that only commerce could make them. His new unpaid workers didn't hurt things either. Ayella and Miri worked as dealers. Ayella wore enough makeup to disguise her true identity. Miri did not need that precaution, but did change her hair color with spray-on hues and combinations each day, just because it was her custom. Two attractive women, a generation apart, skillful conversationalists and card handlers, they drew good-sized crowds at their tables each day, and their tips were grand enough to make Miri wonder whether intelligence was the career she wanted for herself after all. Lando and Han worked the casinos too, but not as dealers. Each day they set up in different casinos, at sabacc tables. Lando maintained his Biscott of Derman identity, and Han continued to put on his yellow-skinned, thin mustache makeup each morning. At the end of each day, they compared their winnings. After the first week, Lando was slightly ahead. Mirak spent most of her time with her father. During years of retirement on Corellia, she had cheerfully ignored her father's efforts to bring her to the Errant Venture to learn and perhaps take over its operations. Now, her homeworld was for the time hostile to her, and she had nothing to do more suited to her talents. So she threw herself into these new studies with typical Mirax obsessiveness, delighting her father. Leia, Wedge, and Corrin concentrated on the data interpretation side of things, seldom venturing into the ship's public areas, Each such trip, however short, would cause them to have to don disguises. They confined themselves to an auxiliary computer cabin provided by Booster and began meticulously assembling and analyzing the data the others provided them. Data came from the drunk patrons and the sober ones, from the happy ones and bitter ones, from the officers with marital problems and straying eyes, from the personnel with accumulated resentments and inadequate filters between their brains and their mouths. The most valuable data often came from patrons who, at the end of their rest and recreation leaves, were dead broke and too drunk to stand. The special circle of Errant Venture employees took care of them, letting them sober up in quiet little lounges, giving them enough credits for a return shuttle flight to their military units, assuming they had bought round-trip fare in the first place, which often they hadn't, and even half-carrying them to the shuttle docks for their outbound flights. Han, Lando, and the other data gatherers became new best friends to an immense number of young soldiers, pilots, and technical personnel. But the information they farmed was frustratingly tenuous. 1 week into their operation, the data gatherers assembled to see if there were any informational gemstones to be found. "I know this is going to sound strange," Leia said, "but I haven't found any indication that this war was precipitated by outside forces. I've been reviewing news reports, historical analysis, all the data we have on hand, and it looks like the central conflict between Corellia and the GA was the inevitable conclusion of their respective political directions."
"Fewer syllables, please," Lando said. "Remember, your husband is at the table."
Han gave him a faintly amused "you're next" look, then turned his attention back to his wife.
"So that means no puppet master?"
She shook her head.
"It means that the war itself is not the puppet master's original plan, or at least not his fault. But the manipulations we think we've detected do add up to something. We can see a cause and effect relationship. We just have to figure out the motive."
Aiella opened up her datapad.
"Events like the Corellian ambush of the GA fleet that came in to intimidate it. The outcome? Corellia remained independent a while longer. If it hadn't, another world would probably have become the focal point of the independence movement. Bothawi or Kaminor would be likely candidates. But Corellia had something they didn't."
Wedge nodded.
"Centerpoint Station, and a secret assault fleet."
"Correct," Aiella said. "Then we have Admiral Kloskin, who pretty clearly was meddled with, if we're right that these Force Ghost manifestations are evidence of our puppet master. The result of that interference? The situation here was worsened. The Alliance was cast in a bad light. Corellia received a lot of sympathy. Speeding up the process by which other worlds considered coming in on Corellia's side," Leia said. "Then the whole thing at Toriyaz Station, the death of Prime Minister Saxon, it caused a change in Corellian leadership, permitting Thrakken Sal Solo to boost himself from Minister of War to President. And with war preparations accelerating, he had to put his secret fleet on the resources list."
Her voice quiet, as though she was hesitant to speak up in this exalted company. Miri said,
"It also scattered the Jedi."
Leia frowned.
"What?"
Miri looked uncomfortable.
"Well, it didn't scatter the Jedi, really. I mean, the Jedi Council on Coruscant wasn't affected. But if you look at family ties, which have made so much of a difference over the years with a Solo Skywalker extended family, one minute you were all together, and then, boom, you were scattered across the galaxy. Some of you at odds. It was like a secret grenade."
Leia and Han exchanged a suspicious look, and Aiella regarded her daughter with interest.
"That's an interesting interpretation," Leia said. Her tone suggested caution, reserve. "I hadn't considered that as a factor."
Miri, her idea not having been shot down by the accumulated aces, began to look more comfortable.
"At school, we were taught the follow the principle. Follow the money, follow the lover, follow the resources. The trick is sometimes in identifying the resources."
Corrin had been nodding ever since the first follow that left Miri's lips.
"You're saying the Solo Skywalker clan is a significant resource, and that it has been eliminated?"
"Yes."
Leia wasn't able to keep a little anger out of her voice.
"We have not been eliminated."
"Not as individuals, no."
Corrin gave her a sympathetic look, but didn't yield.
"But as a family. Tell me that you can send out a call, as you could have done 6 months ago, and focus the attention and skills of your entire family on a single problem or enemy. Tell me that."
Leia thought about it, then seemed to wilt just a little.
"I can't."
Dozens of decks below, a small cargo craft rose in the main hangar bay of the Errant Venture. It wasn't a pretty vehicle. About 40 meters in length from bow to stern, it had a front end, its main cargo hull that was as elegant and aerodynamic as a thick Nerf stake cut into a rectangle and stood up on its edge. Behind that, constituting about a third of the length of the craft, was the maneuvering shaft, a low cylinder housing the main thrusters and the servos that positioned the maneuvering fins, long wing-like surfaces that stretched laterally from the shaft. In short, it looked like the mutant offspring of a bird and a brick, re-engineered by Verpines to fly backward. This example of the YV-666 line had dents, blast scars, and rust patches all over its hull, making it especially unlovely. At the forward portion of the top deck, Captain Uran Levint carefully maneuvered the awkward craft up into the hangar, then followed the glowing spherical droid above a trail of blinking lights on the hangar floor to her assigned berth.
"Soon as we land," she said, "you want to get into the smuggling compartment. They'll do a basic scan from outside."
"We understand." Alima's voice came from a patch of shadow, impenetrable by ordinary sight at the back of the bridge. "Why do they care if there are undeclared passengers?"
"It's all money."
Levint set the craft down with only the faintest of thumps, though that noise was joined by the squeal and creak of Durasteel components settling. She grimaced at the noise.
"If they don't know about you, they can't charge you for, well, anything. Soon as I get my cabin assignment, I'll calm you where it is."
Coruscant, Jedi Temple.
Mara leaned forward, elbows on the table on either side of the datapad retrieved from Lumaya's abandoned quarters, and rested her chin in her hands. Weeks earlier, meticulous police work tracking from the site of the murder of Jedi Master Trasina Lobi had led to an apartment in the Zorp House apartment tower and the realization that the Sith Lady Lumaya was one of the murderers. An encrypted data card was the only clue Lumaya had left behind. From the other side of the table, Luke looked at her.
"You cracked the encryption on the data card?"
"Finally."
"But you don't look happy."
"You don't need a force bond to tell that, farm boy."
"Tell me."
"Some of it's an invoice. The sender seems to have been a bounty hunter working for Lumaya, and the invoice is an itemized list of expenses. Hours worked, fuel expended, blaster shots taken. The main part, though, is a mission status, an event report. Even decrypted, it's hard to puzzle out. Everything is referred to by code words. But assuming I'm putting the right names to some of these code words, the information is interesting."
"Such as?"
"Confirmed that the lady's daughter succumbed to injuries inflicted by grandson 32707, Mara recited. "Please inform if lady's mission changed from insertion observation to revenge." Luke frowned over that one.
"Lady has to be Lumaya. She used to style herself the Dark Lady of the Sith after Emperor Palpatine and my father were no longer around to slap her down for presumption."
"I agree. And if that same time context is the basis for more than one of these code names, grandson would therefore have to be one of Darth Vader's grandsons, right? Jason or Ben."
32707, Luke said.
"Just a second." He pulled out his datapad, connected it remotely to the temple's computer, and went searching for a report Ben had filed weeks earlier. Here it is. BMX-32707. An uninhabited star system near Bamil. That's where the woman Sayo led Jason and Ben, where Jason defeated some sort of dark side force user within the asteroid under her habitat.
Where Nalani Din died."
Mara looked confused.
"Nalani was Lumaya's daughter?"
"No. Nalani's parents have files in the Order database, and Nalani looked a lot like her mother. Besides, Nalani died the same day Jason and Ben arrived at the habitat. Your file there suggests that the lady's daughter lingered for a while." Luke frowned.
"The other woman who was there, Brisha Sayo. Brisha could be an anagram for Shira Bree. Shira Bree. Lumaya's real name."
Luke nodded.
"I didn't make the connection at the time, because then it had been years since we'd heard anything about Lumaya."
A thought was growing within him, and alongside it, a worry, a big one. "Let's say Lumaya has a daughter. She names her Brisha, a self-tribute, and Brisha works with her. Brisha lures Jason and Ben to an ambush. She and the mysterious Sith she claims is living in her basement. Maybe he's just a dark Jedi she's hired. Maybe he's Lumaya's Sith apprentice. Are going to kill Ben. An act of revenge for everything I've done to Lumaya. Or maybe to capture him. Train him to be a Sith. Which is just as much revenge and twice the evil.
I did a thing or two to her as well.
Right. Revenge against both of us. But Nalani is there too, and throws the odds off. The Darksider and Nalani are killed. Brisha is badly wounded. Ben gets a knock in the head and forgets what happened. And Jason presumably never figures out that Brisha was one of the bad guys. Jason and Ben leave, and weeks later, Brisha succumbs to injuries.
And her mother, Mara winced, her mother would want revenge. Against Jason. He's racking up quite a body count against daughters of dangerous opponents of ours.
Luke shook his head. We don't know that Jason wounded Brisha. How could he have done so and then left the habitat without thinking of her as an enemy? Ben must have done it, during one of the periods of time his memory doesn't cover, which would make Ben the target. His stomach began doing flip-flops. In addition to being a cocky teenager alone in a galaxy at war, Ben might now be the target of one of the galaxy's deadliest killers, a woman who had fought Luke to a standstill mere weeks before.
Your theory spooks me, farm boy, because it answers a lot of the questions we've been asking. Why Lumaya would have infiltrated the Galactic Alliance Guard to gather information about Jason or Ben and prepare for revenge if she needed to take it. Why she would have been around for so long as we've known she has been but didn't attack you until a few weeks ago. Because that's when she received word about her daughter dying.
Her frown deepened.
And what if this is the reason for all Jason's bad decisions? What if Brisha or the Sith apprentice on that planetoid got to him, affected him, infected him in some way?
Then whatever's afflicting him might be easily curable. Mara slammed her fist down on the tabletop and turned away from Luke. Far from being pleased by that possibility, she'd been angered by it. And even without the benefit of their force bond, Luke thought he knew why. Because if Jason were the victim of some Sith brainwashing technique, he wasn't responsible for his recent actions. In which case, Mara couldn't forge and sharpen her emotions, her dedication to oppose and eliminate him as a former Emperor's hand should be able to.
We have to find out what happened on that asteroid, Luke said. And we have to confront Jason face to face to do that. We can't be in a position where all he has to do is press an off switch to shut us out.
I agree.
Mara's voice was strained.
Corellian Exclusion Zone, aboard the Errant Venture.
The universe was not cooperating, and Alima Rar was becoming impatient with it. There was a Jedi other than herself aboard Errant Venture. She was sure of it. As she stalked the darkened passageways and shadow-filled casinos, as she wandered, wrapped in robes that concealed her disfigurement, enough to allow her to mingle with drunken gamblers and revelers, she would occasionally feel little pulses and eddies in the Force that were characteristic of Jedi presence. But she never spotted the Jedi. To the logic she employed in her calculations, that meant one thing. The Jedi was hiding. Hiding from her. And therefore, it was Leia. That evening, in the cabin she surreptitiously shared with Captain Levent, she spoke of these matters.
You are almost free of your debt to us, she said. You have brought us to where the Solos, at least Leia, conceal themselves. But we cannot find her, them. When we see them, then you are free.
Bothoe System, aboard the Shamunar.
On the records and assignment sheets, a thin screen of starfighters and armored shuttles equipped with long-range sensors guarded the rimward edge of the star system. If the fleets that were assembling, performing maneuvers and war games, and otherwise rattling their lasers deep within the system, were to head out in a direction of the outer rim, towards, say, Kamino, directly opposite the direction a fleet would most logically take if headed toward Corellia, this screen would detect it and transmit that information to Shamunar for retransmission to the Second Fleet. The Bothans would not be able to take the task force at Corellia by surprise, in theory. In fact, Admiral Kloskin had identified a number of this task force's pilots and officers as traitors. He'd been very careful to flag the ones whom Captain Bjork had already written up for various disciplinary reasons, and to avoid those Bjork indicated he trusted implicitly, Then Kloskin had assigned each of them to the outer rim screen. He and Bjork had positioned Shamanar at the heart of the coverage area and had called in each one of those on-duty pilots in turn, arresting them and seizing their vehicles. Now, though they were still officially on station, each of the alleged traitors was in the brig, and Shamanar floated alone, doing the work of the entire screen by herself. She was more than able for the job, of course. She had been fitted with the best long-range sensor suites a frigate could boast. It was unfortunate that she couldn't remain at her usual station, well outside the Bothawe system, on the Bothawe-Corellia approach corridor. But there, she was merely redundant. Here, she was doing critical work.
"Don't worry," Kloskin told Bjork. "I've transmitted news of our success to Admiral Niathal. She'll be sending replacement vehicles immediately."
"Good to know."
Bjork stood in the middle of the bridge and turned to look at each officer's display in turn. He was restless, and would continue to be until all those replacement forces were in place.
"Your officers look bored."
Bjork gave the Admiral a surprised look.
"I don't think so, sir."
"Still, let's shake them up a bit. I spent part of yesterday putting together a simulation. In the sim, the three Bothan fleets stage a simultaneous breakout, and one heads straight for Shamanar. There's opportunity for a stand-up fight, or for picking off their weaker units."
Bjork smiled at the Admiral's mistake.
"Just telling me that affects my tactics, Admiral."
"So it does. Well, put your second-in-command in charge. You and I will run things from the auxiliary bridge."
"Right."
Bjork turned toward his second, a tall Gotal.
"Lieutenant Syro, you have the bridge for a sim. The Admiral and I will be running it from the auxiliary bridge."
Moments later, Kloskin and Bjork walked into the auxiliary bridge, a small, seldom-used chamber, its walls more thickly lined with displays than any other compartment on the frigate. These displays were just now flickering into life, as were the overhead lights. The bridge doors slid shut behind the two men.
"All overrides default here, correct?"
Kloskin asked.
"It wouldn't be much use as an emergency bridge if they didn't,"
Bjork said.
"Oh, sorry, Admiral. I didn't mean to sound sarcastic."
"You really ought to watch your mouth, son,"
Kloskin said. From his pocket, he pulled a holdout blaster. Bjork's eyes widened, as if he thought the Admiral's gesture were a not-too-funny joke about disciplinary measures. Kloskin shot him in the chest. Bjork went down on his back, the impact making the floor panels ring. Smoke curled up from the scorched patch on his breastbone, and a little blood oozed from the burned flesh. Using the codes he just heard Bjork use to open and activate the auxiliary bridge, Kloskin ensured that the doors could not be opened again. Then he moved to the communications board. He activated a line to the main bridge and said,
"Lieutenant Syro, I'm cutting all external communications. From this point on, any communications you make will actually be going to the SIM program. If you get an override message from the fleet, it will be accompanied by a red blink that indicates I'm the real thing. Understood?"
"Yes, sir."
Kloskin punched in controls that would disable all communication antennas aboard the frigate, all but one, which he reserved for use of his own comm board. He moved to the main computer and inserted a data card into its slot. The computer accepted the program and activated it. All over the ship, every internal door or hatch controlled by a servo slid and locked open. Kloskin imagined the officers on the bridge staring in puzzlement at the doors as intership communications began buzzing with questions. The door into his bridge remained resolutely shut, of course. It wouldn't do for Kloskin to die with the others, though even if he did, his primary mission would still be successful. The main computer display came up with a text message indicating that all safety protocols concerning exterior hatches had been overridden. Kloskin nodded. All he had to do now was stand by, though he did have 10 seconds in which he could abort this sequence. He didn't. And when the 10th second counted down, warning lights and chime alarms began to fill the air. Kloskin switched the main display from view to view. First was the interior of the frigate's small starfighter bay, where the force field holding the atmosphere had just dissipated. Atmosphere rushed out through the great gaping hole through which starfighters normally launched or landed, and some of the starfighters in the bay rocked slightly. A lone mechanic standing too close to the main opening stumbled, forced along by the air currents fleeing into space, and was swept into the void. Her arms flailed as she drifted out toward explosive decompression and death. The next view showed personnel in the ship's mess. They stood looking around, their eyes wild as they began gulping for air. Some began running for emergency control panels and wall comm boards. Others turned around and around, looking for the source of their trouble. He switched the display to look at the bridge. The holocam view from the bridge was dominated by the face of the human communications officer. He was so close to the holocam that his features were distorted. To either side of him, other bridge officers stood, shouting, clutching their throats. He returned to the comm board and punched in a frequency, then activated it.
Kloskin to Koroilin, please respond.
A moment later, the face of a black and tan Bothan appeared on the display.
Koroilin here.
The eye is closed, and Shamanar is ready for a prize crew. She'll be repressurized by the time you get here.
Corellian Exclusion Zone aboard the Errant Venture.
Leia and Luke embraced for a long moment, uncaring that they were surrounded by observers. Those observers were family and friends. And though the private conference room Booster had set aside for his secret guest wasn't exactly as cozy as the vessel's more sumptuous suites, its shortcomings of comfort did not matter. Luke drew away from his sister and followed Mara's lead in shaking hands or offering embraces all around. Han, Lando, Wedge, Corin, Mirax.
It's good to see you, he said.
The words were simple, but they came from his heart. It startled him to feel this level of relief at seeing people in person when he already knew they were alive and well. But, he supposed, the heart did not always believe what the mind knew to be true.
Us too,
Han said, and it was apparent that the distance that had developed between the two men, back when it became clear that Han supported Corellian independence while Luke remained loyal to the Alliance, had finally closed.
Though we're kind of surprised to see you here.
We were in the neighborhood, Mara said. Not a joke. We're in the Corellian system to see if we can pin Jason down, get a few answers from him. Ben is missing.
Leia did not miss the little flash of pain visible in Mara's face, detectable through the Force.
We don't think Jason knows where he is, but he has some information that might lead us to Ben.
You've chosen a good time to visit, then, Wedge said. Jason is here, aboard Errant Venture.
Luke gave him a dubious look.
Jason? Gambling?
No.
Corin shook his head, clearly annoyed.
He's wandering around, looking things over. Maybe he's come to the same conclusion we did, that Errant Venture is a very useful tool for gathering data. Seems a very GAG thing for him to think of. Or maybe he wants to make sure that the ship doesn't constitute a security leak that would help the Corellians. Either way, he's here, so those of us he knows are having to keep even more out of sight. No more gambling, even in disguise, until he goes away, Han added.
There's something else, Leia said. Something I've been sensing through the Force for the last few days. There's a presence aboard ship. Someone or something I can't identify. But it's here, watchful.
I'll keep that in mind, Luke said.
You won't be offended if Mara and I go pin Jason with some questions in a few minutes.
Leia shook her head.
Just be careful. Count on it.
Luke seemed to hesitate before continuing.
In the meantime, there are some things we need to bring you up to date on. Such as Ali Marar and Lumaya, Dark Lady of the Sith, Mara said. And now we have a little Force technique developed by Master Silgal that will help us counter the way Alima meddles with memory. We'll teach you.
Jason stopped a few meters from one of the tables in the Maw Casino to watch a microdroid wrestling match. In the duel currently taking place, a droid shaped like a piranha beetle on treads exchanged fire with one shaped like a Tatooine sandcrawler. They were separated by a few meters of artificial terrain, resembling the towering forests of Kashyyyk. But it wasn't the droid fight that drew Jason's attention. It was the woman facing him from the center of the long edge of the table. He knew her face, and he'd never expected to see it again. He circled the table so that it would not be between them and stepped up next to her. Captain Uron Levint looked up from her bedding and her drink to nod at him.
Colonel Solo, Captain Levent, how did you get here?
That's a silly question, isn't it? I got here in the cargo vehicle you gave me.
She lifted her drink, tilted the container toward him in salute, and took a sip.
Please forgive me for not thanking you before now. The Duracrut has become a good luck charm for me. My fortunes have been improving ever since I took command of her. I've run 3 cargo routes, all at a tremendous profit.
You haven't had any difficulty with her?
Well, she's old. I spent part of your payment to me giving her an overhaul, but nothing catastrophic.
Jason stared down at her, baffled. Jedi could often tell when someone was lying, and Levent was clearly withholding information, but she didn't manifest any of the emotion that should accompany the lies he expected. Then he felt a slight flicker within the Force. He looked up to see Luke and Mara standing just inside the casino entrance, staring at him. He gave the captain a purely artificial smile.
We'll get caught up later. Looking forward to it. You can buy me a drink.
Pushing Levent from his mind, he approached Luke and Mara, offering each a civil handshake.
Master Skywalker, you should have told me you were coming to Corellia.
Where would you have been if we had?
Mara asked. Jason blinked at the question. Aboard the Anakin Solo, probably. Luke gave him a cheerful smile.
Well, it's nice that we could find you when you have more time for socializing. Let's get a table, order drinks.
Not waiting for a reply, he turned and then led the way into the ranks of small tables closer to the bar. He chose an empty one that appeared to have been recently cleaned. Its glowing, glossy surface was still damp, and sat. Mara and Jason joined him. Jason had to struggle just a bit to keep annoyance from his face. This encounter was inconvenient. Luke leaned in close.
Jason, this is important. We need to know exactly what happened on the asteroid near Bamil.
Jason kept his emotions under tight control and attempted to project nothing more than additional annoyance.
It's true, I haven't had time to write a report. My guard commission came in too soon after our return to Coruscant. Was there something wrong with Ben's report?
Well, it's incomplete, Mara said. It doesn't cover what happened while he was unconscious, or what happened to you while you were separated from him.
Oh, of course.
Jason frowned as if trying to dig up memories, buried beneath tons of more recent events.
Well, let's just concentrate on those 2 periods then. Brisha Sayo, Nalani, Ben and I boarded a sort of rail car that took us into the asteroid's interior. A pulse of Force energy yanked Ben and Nalani out of the car. After a moment, Brisha was yanked free. The car stopped in a deep cavern, and there I was attacked by a Force user who radiated dark side orientation and wore your face, Luke.
Luke nodded.
At the same time, I was fighting a Force projection with your appearance, an altered appearance, and Mara and Ben were fighting distorted versions of each other.
That's right.
Jason's mind clicked its way through the details Lumaya had so recently provided as he tried to figure out the best order in which to present the information.
My duel ended when the false Luke hurled some boulders at me, and I inverted into a spin with my lightsaber.
We both connected. I took a rock to the head and was out for a while. But when I woke up, my opponent was in 2 pieces, and once I found his head, several meters away, I could see his true features. A Deveronian. He had no identikard on him. His lightsaber was gone.
Gone?
Mara frowned.
So someone came while you were unconscious and took it.
Jason shrugged as if the detail was of no importance. Probably it just went flying into a cranny somewhere and I couldn't find it. It was a very low-gravity environment. You could throw a lightsaber hilt a kilometer if you tried.
And Ben?
Luke asked.
I found him in an upper cavern, Jason said, unconscious. Brisha Sayo was nearby. She'd lost an arm and had sustained a head injury and sucking chest wound, all of them lightsaber inflicted. I stabilized her. She seemed pretty sure her habitat's medical droids would be able to fix her up. She said she found a wicked-looking redhead. Her description matched Ben's evil Mara, preparing to behead Ben, and that she interfered. She was badly wounded but drove the false Mara into retreat.
Luke and Mara exchanged a glance.
So, Luke said, if she was telling the truth, the timing can only work out one way. The Dark Jedi, or whatever he was, impersonated Mara and attacked Ben. He won that fight. Brisha stopped him from killing Ben, and he ran off. Then he took my face and attacked Jason. and Jason killed him. Mara shook her head. That doesn't work, though. If we assume there was some link between the two Jason-Luke fights and the two Ben-Mara fights, because my fight with the false Ben and your fight with the false Jason were simultaneous.
Suggesting that my fight with the false Luke and Ben's with the false Mara were too. Jason pretended to puzzle that one over.
The only logical conclusion is that there were two enemies in those caverns, not just one.
That's right.
Luke returned his attention to Jason. He hesitated a moment before continuing. Jason, we have evidence that Brisha Sayo was Lumaya's daughter. Jason sat back and allowed a look of startlement to cross his features.
I don't believe it. I'm not that easy to deceive.
She'd be very good at deception, Mara said, if she were trained by her mother.
So, Jason pretended to think it through.
So Brisha probably killed Nalani, and Brisha dueled Ben.
And Ben cut her to ribbons.
A little pride crept into Mara's voice with that remark.
But she defeated him with some ploy, and she probably did something to him, altering his memories, maybe making him vulnerable to other techniques, just before you came across them.
And now, the test of courage, Jason told himself. Do you propose to me that my memories were meddled with too? That my thinking has been altered?
Luke seemed to be on the verge of saying something when he looked up and around. A moment later, Jason and Mara felt it too. A massive surge of surprise, consternation, other emotions from another direction joined the mix. Fear, exultation, anger. Those emotions had to be projected by hundreds, even thousands of people simultaneously to manifest like this through the Force. Jason grabbed his comm link and spoke into it. Colonel Solo to the Anakin Solo. Status check.
Sir!
Jason recognized the voice. It belonged to one of the Anakin Solo's communications officers.
It's a fleet action, sir. There's a fleet incoming. They're everywhere. They're already hitting the task force around Corellia proper.
Jason stood and ran toward the door leading from the Maw Casino.
Bridge of the Dodona.
Recall all scouts, shouted Admiral Tara Limpan. Launch squadrons as they come ready. Threat assessment. What are we looking at?
Finally, a hologramic schematic of space directly around the planet Corellia sprang into existence above the bridge walkway. Admiral Limpan was actually within the hologram. She took two steps backward to be clear of it. On the schematic, the sphere of Corellia was a blue wire grid. Alliance ships were small green symbols. Corellian craft on the planet's surface or within her atmosphere were yellow, and unknowns were red. There were lots of unknowns. Some of them already streaking down into the atmosphere on the far side of the planet from the Dodona. Far too many were approaching Dodona along orbital vectors. Though Colonel Moyen, her starfighter coordinator, was not on the bridge, he remained in the starfighter control salon, a nearby compartment. His growling voice echoed over the bridge's speaker system.
We have two cruisers, a frigate, and a minimum of 12 starfighter squadrons headed our way. That's only the newcomers. There are at least as many starfighter units rising up from Corellia's surface. This is an all-out push. Our deployments around Centerpoint Station and the other four worlds are reporting similar mismatches.
Limpan looked up toward the high speakers, as though Moyen were up there.
Who are they?
They're Bothan assault cruisers, Admiral.
No expression crossed her face, but Limpan felt a twinge of sympathy for Moyen. He was Bothan.
All right, she called. Navigation, plot a course for Centerpoint Station. Order our forces already there to hit the station as hard as they can. Denying it to the Corellians is our top priority. Dodona will join in that action. Where's the Anakin Solo?
Her sensor operator called out.
It was at its usual station, just outside the Saronia orbit, on the direct approach from Coruscant. Now it's coming in. Ask it to join us at Centerpoint.
Limpan could feel the subtle changes in the ship's artificial gravity and see through the viewports at the bow as Dodona slowly wheeled away from her orbit and oriented herself away from the planet's surface.
How many starfighter squadrons do we have on station?
Three, Admiral.
Limpan shook her head rueful. They were going to take a pounding.
Enemy starfighters now reaching our maximum firing range,
Moyen said.
Open fire, Limpan said. The order is fire at will.
Aboard the Errant Venture.
Wedge and Corrin angled into the flag hangar, each skidding as he made the hard turn from the corridor. Their astromechs had done a preliminary power-up, and the canopies of both snub fighters were already open.
Wedge was first to his vehicle, but Corrin, rather than climbing the ladder hanging from his cockpit, leapt lightly into his pilot's couch. Wedge swore at the Jedi under his breath and climbed his ladder.
What have we got, sweetie?
Aiella's voice crackled back across his comlink.
Unknown forces hitting every major position held by the Second Fleet in the system. Wait, not unknown. The Centerpoint Station Task Force is reporting Kaminoian markings on the assault forces. The Trilus and Corellian blockade forces are reporting Bothan markings. We have a small force. One frigate and one squadron of fighters headed our way. And the Dodonna has ordered Errant Venture not to enter hyperspace until every spaceworthy fighting vehicle aboard is launched.
Wedge swung nimbly into his cockpit. He yanked the ladder free of his fuselage and dropped it to the hangar floor. He slid down into the couch, clamped his helmet on, closed the canopy. Corrin's voice came across his helmet speakers.
Silly operational question. What's our squadron designation?
Wedge snorted. They ought to have one for purposes of coordination and efficiency, but the question just seemed slightly ridiculous under the circumstances.
Ganner. I'm Ganner 1, you're Ganner 2.
He checked his status display.
4 lit, 4 green. Open hangar doors.
Say please,
Aiella said.
Just kidding.
The flag hangar lights dimmed, and the outer doors slid aside. Wedge and Corrin circled to the length of the Errant Venture, heading toward the stern. They could see starfighters and other vehicles dropping out of the ship's belly bays like explosives dropping from a bomber. The starfighters ignited thrusters, turned toward the world of Corellia, and blasted in that direction. The more distant ones were already leaping forward and vanishing, the visual effect to outsiders of their entering hyperspace. 2 X-Wings from the main hangars came alongside, matching speed and vector. Wedge was startled. They hadn't appeared on his sensor screen until they were a few hundred meters away. But as they drifted into visual range, he saw why. They were stealth X-craft. Their surfaces looked dark and oddly modeled because of the sensor-deafening coatings they wore. Wedge changed his comm frequency to a general military hailing range. He thought he knew the answer, but asked anyway.
Who've we got there?
Hello, Wedge.
Luke, I take it your talk with the Colonel was cut short. Mara's your wing, correct?
Yes. Going to deal with Errant Venture's pursuit?
Just until the Venture can jump to a safe zone.
Makes sense. You do realize that you're attacking your own allies, don't you?
No one trying to blow up the old man who became my benefactor when I was orphaned is my ally, Luke. By the way, you're now Ganner 3, and Mara's Ganner 4.
There was a short pause.
For Ganner Rhizode?
Luke asked. Rhizode, a Jedi Knight, had died on Coruscant during the Yuuzhan Vong War, fighting and killing more enemy warriors in personal combat than perhaps any other combatant in the war.
Can you think of a better name for someone fighting a delaying action?
No. Who's Ganner 2? Corrin?
Corrin's voice was crisp across the comm channel.
Hello, boss.
Corellian space.
Jason's shuttle was on the verge of entering hyperspace and jumping toward the Anakin Solo's position, just outside the star system on the most direct route toward Coruscant, when he received a new message from the Star Destroyer relaying Admiral Impan's request for assistance at Centerpoint Station. Jason authorized the change in plans, quickly plotted a new jump for Centerpoint, and launched into hyperspace shortly afterward. When he dropped from hyperspace, the Centerpoint engagement was spread out before him. In the background was the station itself, the ugly, cylindrical, kilometers-long mass of it. Nearer were the Galactic Alliance Mon Calamari heavy carrier, Blue Diver, and 2 sturdy-looking Kara-class gunships. Jason stayed well back. The light laser cannon on his shuttle would not add much firepower to the Alliance forces, and he might not be able to detach himself from a skirmish when he needed to. His sensor screen blipped with the arrival of a new force and showed him the blue triangle of the Anakin Solo, just arrived from hyperspace, racing toward the engagement. He heeled over, taking an intercept course that should bring him alongside the Anakin before it reached the engagement and allow him to get aboard before the Anakin had to open up with its weapons batteries, assuming that enemy starfighters didn't rush to engage. He was in luck, though. None of the enemy forces at the station disengaged to meet the Anakin, and Jason reached the command salon within minutes. There, Commander Twizzle, commanding officer of the Anakin Solo, greeted him with a simple nod.
We're preparing to bring the long-range lasers to bear against the gunships.
Belay that, Jason said. Use them to reinforce Blue Diver's fire against the station. Twizzle scowled.
Kill more enemy troops rather than preserve the lives of our own?
Colonel, that's a bad choice under these circumstances.
It's our only choice. Can't you see what's going on? Admiral Limpan wouldn't have ordered the attack on the station if she weren't sure that the enemy forces could drive us out of the system. And if we are driven out and leave an intact Centerpoint station behind...
Yes, Colonel. Twizzle didn't sound convinced, but turned to the weapons officer.
Take a new target. Centerpoint station. Continuous fire. Inflict as much damage as possible.
Corellian space.
Luke had to agree that Wedge's improvised plan was a good one, or would be if it worked. But then he decided that was true of all plans. In retrospect, they were only as good as they were successful, regardless of how brilliant they might have appeared before execution. He and Mara were many kilometers out ahead of Wedge and Corrin, and a few kilometers to one side of the straight-line approach the enemy force was taking. As soon as their sensors detected the incoming frigate, he and Mara shut down all active systems and went dead in space, merely drifting. From this point until they rejoined Wedge and Corrin, they would not use their comm systems. Their force bond, undetectable by sensors, would be their only means of communication. Passive sensors showed Wedge and Corrin approaching the enemy force, showed the enemy starfighters arraying themselves out in front of the frigate as a defensive screen. Luke nodded. These were wise, basic tactics. The frigate and starfighter screen passed Luke and Mara's position, and Luke's sensor showed the frigate to be an axe-shaped Nebulon B. The Jedi waited there and watched the battle begin. Wedge and Corrin, staying so close to each other that they were sometimes one blip on the sensors, darted to one edge of the starfighter screen. There was a swirl of activity there, and suddenly, Wedge and Corrin were in retreat. 11 enemy starfighters remained, and one was dead in space, its pilot requesting shuttle pickup over comm frequencies. Luke gave Mara a simple prod through the force, then lit his thrusters and began to maneuver in behind the frigate. She tucked in beside him, and he could feel a cool readiness flow from her, a dispassionate willingness to inflict damage, kill, even die as necessary. Their approach was smooth and slow, designed to benefit from these X-Wings' comparative invisibility to sensors. They needed to come as close as possible and launch their proton torpedoes before the frigate's crew realized they were there. At the moment, the frigate was running with its shields most powerful at the bow, weaker at the stern. A sensible measure, as Wedge and Corrin were keeping the starfighter skirmish out ahead of the frigate. Closer they came, now 100 kilometers behind the frigate, now 90. When they were so close that their attacks would take less than a second to reach the frigate, but not so close that retaliatory laser fire would be at point-blank range, Luke fired a torpedo. A split second later, Mara fired hers. Luke activated his X-Wing shields and through their force bond, felt Mara do the same. The torpedo thrusters drew a near instantaneous straight line to the frigate's stern. Luke's torpedo detonated against its rear shields, then Mara's disappeared into the blast zone and detonated as well. It took a few moments for the superheated gases of the explosions to dissipate. As they cleared, they revealed a frigate stern that was badly damaged, deeply cratered. Luke couldn't see a single functioning thruster. He gave a little whoop. One enemy was out of commission, and the loss of life had to have been low. If luck was with the frigate, it might have lost no personnel at all. Luke and Mara accelerated in an arc toward the starfighter engagement. Sensors now showed 8 activities in the engagement zone. Wedge, Corrin, and 6 hostiles. On Luke's sensor screen, the computer finally identified the hostiles. I-7 Howl Runners. The Stealth X-Fighters were only a few kilometers from the engagement zone when the 5 still functional Howl Runners broke away, roaring back toward the frigate. Luke and Mara let them go. The Howl Runners took up position circling the crippled frigate, a far more pathetic defensive screen than they had been mere minutes before. Luke reactivated his comm transmitter. What now?
Back to the Errant Venture for me, Wedge said, to get protection until it makes the jump into hyperspace. I'm not going to get involved in the main battle. Honestly, I wouldn't know whose side to be on.
Mara asked,
how about you, Corrin?
Corrin sounded just a little uncertain.
It's kind of up to you, Luke. I've tended to all my personal business on Corellia. I don't need to go back. Where do you need me?
Coruscant, Luke answered instantly. We need all the good sense and sharp thinking we can get at the temple. But for now, Mara and I will be heading to the main engagement to see what good we can do for the Alliance forces. You want to come along or head back to the temple?
I'll fight.
Wedge said,
Luke, you're Ganner 1 now. Best of luck.
Likewise. As Wedge peeled off from their formation and set a course for the Errant Venture,
Luke opened up his comm board to listen across military frequencies to find out what was happening and where.
Aboard the Dodona.
Admiral Impan retreated to the command salon, which was smaller, quieter, and less frantic than the bridge. Now she could hear herself think again, and could more easily track the battle's progress. And Dodona's probable death. The Galactic-class battle carrier, commissioned less than a year before, was being chewed to pieces by the Bothan forces pursuing her. She might not last long enough to flee the solar system. The constant pounding by the laser batteries of enemy cruisers, and just as damaging, the missiles and torpedoes of enemy starfighters, was taking a terrible toll on Limpan's flagship.
"Ready to enter hyperspace, Admiral," her navigator announced.
"Launch," she said.
The exterior view, brought in by the salon's displays, showed the stars twist, become streaks of light, and then instantly revert to stars again, because this hyperspace jump was very short, not even leaving the system. Centerpoint Station and the furious fight being waged around it appeared on the main display.
"Navigation," Limpan said. "Plot a course to send us on an approach close to the station, at optimal range for our batteries. We'll make one pass and pour as much damage as we can into her. Then we're outbound. Our next jump will take us to... Fenn, what's the designation for the muster point you use for your initial assault on the system?"
Colonel Fiev Fenn, a female Sulliston, turned from her station computer.
"Point Bleak," she said.
Fenn had been the aide to Limpan's predecessor, Admiral Kloskin. Limpan had her own aide, but had transferred Fenn to starfighter coordination duty and was pleased with her work in that role.
"Once we're past center point, if we survive," Limpan thought, "our next jump will take us to Point Bleak. Communicate with all other Alliance forces. Tell them to break off the engagement and join us there. Tell Errant Venture they have the option of joining us there also."
Limpan settled into her command chair and scowled at the main display. Scowled at Fenn's back. The chair vibrated beneath her as Dodona sustained another torpedo hit. More red lights flashed on the diagnostic displays. More quietly, Limpan added,
"Communications. Let Blue Diver know that as soon as we reach Point Bleak, she's to come alongside. I'll be transferring the flag to Blue Diver."
"Yes, ma'am,"